This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And I'd like to turn the tables a bit and look at the impact on doctors more than patients, at least with this story. A woman went into premature labor on an Air Canada flight, and of course, the call went out for doctors. There were two on board, and by the way, mother and baby are doing fine. But what about a situation like that when the doctor is not at work and a call for help comes, and possibly it's something the doctor is not prepared for or it's not in his or her area of practice? We'll look at that. Also, we marked the fourth anniversary of the pandemic earlier this week, and it's Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. The numbers to call: 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Elisa Naiman, family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto. Dr. Fahad Razak, Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the University of Toronto. And Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist, former head of the BC Cancer Agency. Welcome. Thanks for joining us, everyone.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Hi, Libby.
Hi. Dr. Moore, Malcolm, I want to start with you because I know that story about the birth on the plane, that's a positive thing, obviously. But I know that you have been called upon. You're a good athlete, by the way, people should know, to deal with at least one person who was having a heart attack on a squash court.
Yeah, it's funny. When I heard that the news, I was listening to the story yesterday, and I was thinking to myself, God, what would I do if this woman delivering a baby on an airplane? Because I haven't delivered a baby since medical school. So thank God there was people there capable of doing it. I'm sure we all have stories. I don't have anything to compare with that. I guess the thing for me is I do play squash, and on three separate occasions, either in a match I've been involved in or at the club I was at, somebody's had a cardiac arrest and we've had to resuscitate them. And the whole thing about cardiac arrest is timely intervention. And fortunately, these days we have portable defibrillators. So certainly in one of the cases, it saved this man's life by having the portable defibrillator present. But I'm sure just the other two similarly have stories that they've had to intervene when they're not at work.
Well, and with a cardiac arrest, I'm sure that as an oncologist, there are medical episodes. So that's something that you would have dealt with since medical school.
Yeah. I felt comfortable dealing with that, delivering a baby. The first thing I'd do is look around and see if there's anybody who's more capable. But ultimately, If you're the most capable person who's around, I think we all feel this obligation to step in and help as much as we could. So I'd probably try to fumble through it if I was the only doctor on the plane.
Okay. And they're also midwives. Presumably they know how to deliver a baby. Dr. Razak, have you had to step in cases like that?
Definitely not childbirth, but I have had a couple of times. Actually, the first time that I had to really be involved was on my honeymoon. We were flying to Europe, and there is someone who had passed out mid-flight, and they were on the floor, and I was attending to them. After spending maybe 15 or 20 minutes trying to figure out what was happening and treating them, I looked up and there was a lineup of other people. in the hallway who wanted to be seen, and my wife said, It's like you're running a clinic in the hallway of this plane right now. Nothing serious. Everything was very treatable. Again, nothing as, I think, acute as childbirth. I'll tell you one thing I was shocked by, though. I was shocked by how bad the equipment was on the plane. So to do those kind of assessments, I mean, you are pretty isolated up in the air there. You don't, as physicians, we're used to having a lot of diagnostic tools at our fingertips when we're seeing a patient. There are basic things that could be put into a plane. Like, for example, the stethoscope honestly looked like it was from Fisher-Price to me. It was like a plastic stethoscope that I would buy for a toddler, and I couldn't hear a thing. Like, I had my ear against the patient's chest because I could hear better that way than using this plastic stethoscope. So I think there are a few things they could put on these planes that would actually much improve our ability to provide care. Obviously, you can't have all of the equipment, but, you know, a good stethoscope, a few other things, a pen light to check reflexes, a few other things could be helpful, I would say.
That's a very interesting point. Dr. Naiman, I bet you're the one on this panel who actually knows how to deliver a baby.
I haven't delivered a baby in a while, but I think, I would hopefully things would come back from all those years of training before. But luckily, nothing has ever happened to me on an airplane. But last September of 2022, I sit on a board, and it was our first meeting in person since the start of the pandemic, and one of the individuals went into cardiac arrest in the middle of the board meeting.
Oh, my God.
And, it was really bad. And luckily, there was another person on the board who used to be a nurse. And so the two of us were trying to help this man and resuscitate him. And luckily, there was a defibrillator that was available. But the interesting part of the story is, and I'll just tell everybody that he's fine and he made it. And we got him off to the hospital and we continued on with the board meeting. So everything kept going. But what was interesting was that in September 2022, when you called 911, there was a really long wait. You were put on hold, and it actually took a long time for an ambulance to come. So much so that another person on the board, her husband is a paramedic, and he is like a solo person who goes around to other places. He's an advanced care person. And she actually called her husband, who was actually working, and he actually arrived before the paramedics came. And I was just looking at the other person, the two of us. Everybody was outside, and I don't think they knew the extent of how bad it was, but we were just watching this man die in front of us. And luckily, we were able to resuscitate him. And it was quite scary. And to this day, I still get very nervous now when we have in-person board meetings that something is going to happen. And I think this is why they kept me on the board, was because I was the only physician who's on the board. Everybody else is an engineer or a lawyer or something else. And so I had some type of skill that I could finally apply.
Okay. Wow.
Can I say one more thing, Libby?
Yeah.
I just remembered. One thing I also found very surprising is that So this is a transatlantic flight that I was on. So no help in sight. I mean, many hours from being able to land somewhere. They asked me to prove that I was a physician. And by just absolute chance, I had forgot to take my hospital badge out of my backpack while I was packing for this trip. And so it was in there. It was in one of the pockets. I was able to pull it out. But otherwise, they wouldn't have allowed me to provide support. And I don't know if that is a general policy, if Alyssa or Malcolm have been asked that before, but there was, you know, I don't know if people will fake being clinicians to provide care in an emergency, but they would not allow me to do anything until I could prove that I was a clinician.
Wow. The plot gets thicker. I want to ask about cases where mouth-to-mouth is needed. I'm going to tell a little bit of a personal story, and this person is obviously not a humanitarian, but somebody that I played tennis with, she's a doctor, but she has not been practicing. And I think there was a case of someone being saved by getting mouth-to-mouth, and we're sitting there having coffee after a match, and she's saying, "Oh, God, that is just so disgusting, and you never know what you could get. I would never do that." So, I mean, is that because she's not a very giving person? Or what's your take on that, Dr. Naiman, when mouth-to-mouth is needed?
Listen, your friend, she brings up a good point, and I know that I've thought in the past if you can purchase a guard that you can apply. And I've often thought about just having something in my car just in case. But I think that in the meantime, that it would be adequate in terms of just providing chest compressions until somebody could arrive. But listen, it's something definitely that you would have to think about. But I think in the moment of everything going on, I think probably I would just go ahead and give mouth-to-mouth if that was what was be required.
Dr. Moore?
Another point to make here is that mouth-to-mouth is actually not recommended anymore during cardiac arrest. And I think there are several reasons for this. One is that the important thing is the chest compressions as opposed to mouth-to-mouth. So if you're doing a single resuscitation, if you do mouth-to-mouth, you have to stop doing the chest compressions. And honestly, one of the other reasons is that there's a worry that people will be more reluctant to intervene and help someone resuscitate someone because they don't want to do mouth-to-mouth. So mouth-to-mouth is actually restricted now to a much smaller group of indications than it used to be.
So, and what are those indications?
Those are usually for, like, for infants, for somebody who almost drowns, or for things like drug overdoses where people stop breathing or have some sort of problem with their breathing specifically.
Okay. Dr. Razak, fourth anniversary of the pandemic. You, of course, were the last scientific advisor. So what are your thoughts on that?
I feel very mixed about it, to be honest. I think there are certainly some positive things that have come out of our experience. First and foremost, the impact of the disease has greatly, greatly improved in terms of most people. The acute illnesses that happen from a COVID infection, the number of people in hospital, and especially in an ICU type setting, has gone down precipitously. And that's the impact of vaccinations and of infections and the collective immunity we have. I want to, I'll point out that the problems of infection and long COVID remain an important problem. So although the acute impact has decreased, I do worry significantly, and Stats Canada information does support this, that there are a rising number of Canadians with chronic symptoms in the multiple millions, I should say, based after a COVID infection. And this is a serious issue that can affect quality of life, work, school, family. It can affect things across the board. The things that make me worried is that as the pandemic has receded, some of the most harmful parts of the pandemic have persisted. So the rise of misinformation is really, really significant. And, we talked, I think, last week or the week before about measles cases. That's just one manifestation of this rise of misinformation. So the reluctance of people now to not only get a COVID vaccine, but measles vaccines for their kids. This is misinformation in action. A depleted workforce. We're seeing the shortage of nurses and physiotherapists and physicians across the board. This is a workforce that really took a battering this last 4 years. And how long will it take to improve? I don't know. And then just the general erosion of solidarity. It almost feels like a different world in those early times of the pandemic when people were banging on their pots and supporting healthcare workers and we were all in it together. Think about how divisive these ideas now feel, or divided society feels compared to that. So look, this was an experience that killed more than 50,000 Canadians, more people than in World War II. I'd like to think that we will head to a better, more resilient future in the country, a stronger system of research, a stronger system of pandemic prevention. But today in 2024, we're not there. I think, in fact, the system is more depleted than it was in 2019.
And, the question is, are we going to be prepared? I mean, there were all kinds of reports after SARS, and then we found that our stockpiles of PPE were expired and not replaced. And now we have some businesses that shifted to produce PPE suing the government over that decision. So are we going to be prepared, Malcolm? I mean, have we learned enough to be prepared for the next one?
I'm hopeful, and I think Fahad is better placed to answer this. I'm hopeful that as the dust has settled on COVID, there are thoughtful, sensible people like Fahad sitting down with the decision makers to figure out how do we handle the next pandemic, because there will be another one, there's no question. And, you know, some of the things that were done, mistakes were clearly made, but at the time, you know, things looked pretty desperate. And so you can kind of understand some of the things that were made, mistakes that were made. But I'm kind of hopeful that there will be, you know, non-political, non-adversarial working groups planning for the next pandemic so that it won't be so chaotic. Final point, I would just like to say, what really hit me during the pandemic was the social isolation of people who are seriously ill, where you had people with advanced cancer who were in hospital, who had little to no visitors, and you know, people in nursing homes who were basically isolated for 2 and 3 months. And I'm hopeful that the next time one comes around, we'll find a way to do this without isolating people, because I think the trauma from that is quite significant.
Oh, yeah. Terrible. Alisa, I think that the pandemic really changed, especially family practice in terms of virtual care and use of technology became much more acceptable. Also, I noticed it really increased when the government gave billing codes for it.
So that's right. And if I could just tell you, like 4 years ago today, 4 years ago on the Wednesday, this Wednesday, I was working my after hours, as I've mentioned on the show, that I work with my Wednesday evening after, and it was absolutely terrible. We had no PPE. It was impossible to get. It was all going to the hospitals and to other areas. And we would screen everybody. And at that time, the screening was for the original countries like China and other countries that we would screen people for. But we would ask people to come in, and they would have a fever. And so many patients had come back from the States with a fever. And we would be like, you can't come in. And they would lie to the secretary. And that night, I remember the secretary crying. And then me as a business owner and as a physician had to make a decision. What were we going to do that was going to protect people? And so that Wednesday night, I remember speaking to somebody else. And we made the decision that we were not going to have any more. We were just continuing with our pre-booked appointments that we had until the Friday. And then we basically shut down the clinic. And people were so angry with us because this is before everything shut down that following Tuesday. And they were mad and they were banging on the door and they wanted to come in. And at that time, there was no virtual care because there was no code. The government, I'll take a step back. The government a couple of months before had allowed people who were within these rostered models, so in these family health organizations, that you could use the government online platform and you could have patients booked, so you would be able to do some visits not by having people come in. So I had the technology I had already set up, but the system was so bad that then secretaries would have to walk the people through how to get online, and it was honestly like it was a disaster. And then I think later in the week or the following week, then the government allowed us to have phone calls, and that basically like saved things, and we were able to communicate with patients and at the same time get paid and be able to pay our staff. And I just remember it being like, okay, how do I make this decision? I'm going to affect people's ability to seek care. I'm going to have people who aren't going to be able to earn an income, but what do I have to do? And it was this Wednesday that this whole thing happened. It's when, you know, Donald Trump came on and had his talk on TV and the NBA shut things down. Everything happened that Wednesday. And to look back and go, oh my gosh, this has been 4 years. I can't believe how things have changed. And you know what? Virtual care, I think, is important. And I think the pandemic sort of pushed things ahead by 5 years because I think the government really did not have a desire to bring in virtual care.
Well, yeah, and if you don't need to actually get to a doctor's office, sit around, wait, all of that, why not have virtual care? This is an aside for Dr. Naiman, based on a personal experience. So as we know, I love my GP. He's 83. We talk on the phone, we email, and he does go to the office sometimes. But I had to go and be seen for something when he wasn't going to be in. So I went to what was clearly the newest doctor there. Now, I don't expect a doctor to read my whole chart, but I do expect them to glance at it. And it's not the first time this has happened to me. This person had no idea who I was, what my history was, and she was actually seemed quite shocked. So I'm asking you, Dr. Naaman, you know, what is it? Do doctors not have to prepare at least a little for patients?
So how in our office, how it works is that because we provide this after-hours care, that if your doctor's not working and it's something that needs to be seen and it needs to be seen that day, then you'll come to the evening clinic. And so then it's a walk-in, so I don't have an opportunity to review the patient record. But when I'll take the history from somebody, and you have access to the record, so everything is clearly on the EMR and very, like, you can see everything. But I'll often ask patients, you know, is there something that you can tell me about your history that you think I should know? Or I just want to confirm you have no allergies, or are these the medications that you're taking if I need to prescribe something? But if it would be somebody, if it would be in your circumstance that it would be somebody that I would be seeing during the day, usually another physician in the office would ask me to see them, and then they would usually tell me the background or the importance of why this person needed to be seen at that time and that they needed an appointment. So usually that communication does happen. So I'm sorry that it didn't happen in your case. And luckily you're able to advocate and to tell your medical history, but otherwise it can cause big problems.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the first time. I remember once I had a phone appointment with a specialist and it took forever. And it's like, lady, could you not, like, at least read part of what's in front of you? I mean, I didn't go back to her. But it's just, you know, I know that when I used to have appointments with Dr. Moore, they prepared very well. But
yeah, so in general, people will complain to me and they'll say that they've had a specialist appointment and they felt that the person hadn't even reviewed their file. So it's disappointing because there could be something that was missed missed in terms of the history that needed to be recalled in order to determine the future management. So it does frustrate patients. They will tell me, you know, that's one of the benefits of having a family doctor. There's, as opposed to going to a walk-in clinic, you have somebody who's followed you for many years and knows who you are and knows how things have been in the past and can apply that knowledge to future management and future treatment. So that's the benefit of having a primary care doctor that you see on a regular basis.
Yeah, unfortunately, the latest numbers are that over 2 million Ontarians don't have one. I'd like to spend the last few minutes we have talking about Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. I think that some of the guidelines fairly recently within the last few years changed, Dr. Moore.
Yeah, so unlike parrot fever, which we talked about last week and which affects maybe less than 1 in a million Canadians, colorectal cancer is a serious problem. And just to give you a few background figures, 1 in 25 of the people listening to this broadcast today will develop colon cancer in their lifetime, and about 1 in 40 will die from it. And it is the second leading cause of cancer death. And so you're talking about 25,000 new cases a year. The really significant thing is that with proper screening, we could probably reduce the death rate by much more than 50%. And the biology of this is that colon cancer always develops from initially benign growths that are called polyps. And it takes 5 to 15 years for a polyp to go from a benign growth to a cancer. So if you screen people with colonoscopies, and that, you know, the current recommendations are 50, and if you have a clean colonoscopy, only every 10 years. And the reason it's only 10 years is because if you're screened and you have no polyps, the likelihood of you developing a cancer in the next 10 years is quite small. What's changed recently is that for reasons that are not totally clear, there's been a spike in the incidence of colon cancer in people younger than 50. And that's commonly, colon cancer occurs in people in their 60s and 70s, but for some reason, we're seeing a significant increase in cases in people less than 50. And so what you're starting to see is that the screening guidelines are moving to an earlier age of screening. American Cancer Society has moved it from 50 to 45. But basically, everybody who's over 50 should definitely be screened for colon cancer, either with periodic colonoscopies or with annual testing of stools to see if there's any bleeding.
Yeah, I was. I thought that the recommendation was more of the less invasive tests that people, I would guess, are probably a little squeamish about.
Yeah, I think, you know, you could get into an argument about the pros and cons of this. The problem with having everybody do colonoscopies is that, honestly, we don't have the capacity at the present time to actually provide that. And so the current methodology is that everybody should have regularly stool testing for blood, because cancers typically will bleed into the bowels. And if someone has symptoms or if they have a positive fecal blood test, then they would have a colonoscopy. You know, so that's the current recommendation in Canada.
Final question. My husband had his last week, and he was told that it would likely be his last one. So why is there, what is the age cutoff, and why is there an age cutoff?
You know, that's an interesting question, right? And it's like, at what age do you stop screening? And it's sort of based on an assumed life expectancy of someone who's 70 or 75. So I guess if you're actually that age, and I think we had a caller a few weeks ago who was told he didn't need to be screened because he was too old. But, you know, some people who are 75 still have a life expectancy of 10 or 15 years. And so, but the basis of saying you stop at 70 or you stop at 75 is that the could cause your demise when you get to that age, that the impact of colon cancer screening is much smaller.
Well, people are living a lot longer, so.
No, I agree.
Okay, I'm looking at the clock. It is time to wrap things up. Thank you so much, Dr. Alisa Naiman, Dr. Fahad Razak, and Dr. Malcolm Moore. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, Libby.
Okay, we are taking a break, and when we come back, we are going to be talking about the latest, quote, innovation in what you're going to find at the grocery checkout, and people are not liking it.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Canada's most profitable and possibly most hated grocery chain is at it again, as if shoppers don't have enough issues with self-checkout. Now, Loblaw is testing receipt scanners at four of its locations. And in an attempt to combat theft at its stores, that's what they are doing. And I was wondering why there are gates at the self-checkout aisle, because now they just kind of open. But presumably, once these scanners are introduced, they won't let you out until they check your receipt. So what do you think of that? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now let's go to Ellen Roseman, consumer advocate and journalist. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Libby. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. What do you think of this?
Good. Well, it's interesting the way it was covered by the CBC, where they talked to a number of people at these stores where it's being tested. And this is an issue right away. If it's being tested, why aren't people even aware of it? It was just kind of put in, and they were discovering it as they went along. And many people were going through the gates and setting off alarms because they didn't know that they had to scan the receipts, or even if they did, they probably might have had trouble figuring out how to do those receipts. But in general, I think that they talk about being held a prisoner, you know, and I have Loblaws near me at DuPont and Christie, where they do have a big, big area with about 20 different self-scanners, nothing else, and a gate that you have to go out. There's no scanner there yet, but I felt like it was like a zoo or something, where we were all working hard, and then they had a couple of people in there to help us. But what are they going to do if you refuse to go through the scanner? They can't hold you there. You're not a prisoner. They don't have a right to detain you, especially if they have no proof that you did anything wrong. So they're taking the approach that every customer is a potential thief, and they're making sure that if you scan the receipt, at least they'll know that you bought something. and that you're not sneaking out with goods that you shouldn't have. And they're denying that. They're saying there's nothing to do with ordinary people. This is organized theft that they're worried about.
Give me a break. That article said quoted them as talking about organized crime. How is a receipt scanner going to prevent organized crime? And it's completely ridiculous. And I also, you know, we live not too far from each other. I don't go to Loblaws very often, but when I do, and I notice, is I thought, why are they having this gate here? Because you just get through it. And it is, I mean, I think a lot of things about self-checkout are egregious, mostly that this company charges enough and makes enough profit. So why am I doing the work of people that they are going to or have already fired to save money?
Right. I actually had a problem one day in that store with the pricing of an item, and I had to go back to the shelves three times to check it. And each time I had to go through this gate, and it was so long. It was like way on the other side of the store, and it just made things much more complicated.
Well, yeah, sometimes you can kind of, it depends which helpers they have there, because normally I would only use a self-checkout if I have one or two items with a barcode. And if it's really busy at a cashier and I have stuff that has to be weighed, it's like, forget it. I'm not doing that for Galen Weston, right? I will, you know, leave it there. But sometimes if they're not busy, the person, the helper there will come over and do the figuring out. And it's a lot faster than waiting for a cashier, since they have fired all those cashiers, I guess.
That's right. And the same thing with Shoppers Drug Mart. There seems to be only one cashier in the store, so they're forcing you to use the self-checkout machines, and they can be baffling as well.
Yeah, and you can't get any of people use senior discounts or something like that. You won't get that at self-checkout.
Yeah, that's right. And I can see why, because everybody on Thursday would say they were senior, and the machine wouldn't know the difference.
Yeah. I'm going to take, okay, people, let me give the numbers out again. I bet people have a lot to say about this. 416-360-0740. Toll free 1-866-740-4740. And Loblaw is testing a system of using a receipt scanner, and they're going to hold you inside the self-checkout area if you don't scan your receipt. Right now, it's only in about four stores, but wait for it. It looks like they're ready for it. Let's go to Brad in Holland Landing. Hi, Brad.
Hey, Libby. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just curious what the Ontario Fire Marshal's Office and local fire authorities think of, you know, keeping people captive in the store. If there is emergency activation, you know, have to be evacuated. How is everybody going to get out, you know, one at a time, show your receipt?
That's a very good question.
That's all I wanted to say about that. It seems kind of strange they can keep you captive in the store.
Yeah, I wonder if it's even legal.
It'd be good to talk to the OFM and see what they have to say.
Okay, thanks for that. Yeah, Ellen, I wonder if that is even legal.
I don't think so, because they have no proof or even suspicions that you've stolen anything. They'll just say this is part of their routine, and maybe they'll start putting warnings on the front of the store saying that you shouldn't go in if you have a concern. Also, I think in a public safety issue like what your guest was just talking about, that they would have to just say, forget it, we're going to not worry about scanning the receipts. We want you out of the store quickly.
Yeah, I know, but I guess somebody would have to change the technology that's set up.
I wonder about that, yeah. There must be a way to deactivate. You know, like they have the shopping carts that freeze, and sometimes you're stuck in the store with this freezing one and you can't even get to the cash, so they'll have someone to come and unfreeze it with their technology.
Right, but how many of their employees actually know, will you know, in an emergency situation, I don't think that every employee at Loblaw will know how to activate or deactivate those gates. And yeah. I think I don't know how much they actually care about backlash, because it hasn't hurt their bottom line at all. But I think this would definitely get people's back up. And remember, Ellen, at the beginning, not at the beginning, but a few months ago, we were hearing about cashiers or security guards checking receipts from a self-checkout.
Right. So similar to what Costco does.
Yeah, well, people didn't like that either, and I guess this is the automating of that. Let's go to Louie in Toronto. Hi, Louie.
Hi, Libby. How are you?
I'm fine. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, so what I was mentioning to the fellow there who's screening, in the area where I live, I've noticed, like, in the last 2 years, like, the shoplifting has gone up considerably. Like, when I go shopping, I see packages opened everywhere, in the washrooms, you know, on the shelves, bottles open, people drink the stuff, leave the empty bottle on the shelf. They have put in security guards, I noticed about a year or two, but they don't really check any receipts. They're just standing at the door there. And then one other major thing I noticed up where I am, the Walmart, which is in a mall, connected to a mall, they had two entrances, the mall entrance and the street entrance. And they were both, they have checkout, self-checkout on both ends. So they, the mall entrance recently, they drywalled it up completely and they closed that entrance because of the shoplifting was so much, like it was uncontrollable. And the other thing they did is the self-checkout that's left open on the street one, they don't open it till 12 o'clock. And they also only have like three of the machines open, and they've got about eight of them there.
Okay, Louis, thanks for that update. Yes, shoplifting has increased. It's partly because the cost of living is so high. I think there are a lot of other reasons that grocery prices are so high and continue to go up. I mean, this is a bit of another topic, but the grocery chains charge fees to the suppliers for you know, the way they display the goods. They raise the fees to the suppliers, and when the price of goods go up, they blame the suppliers who are passing on the increased fees. I mean, I just find it incredible.
Right. This is a trial project, and it sounds like it hasn't advanced very far. So it's probably delivering results to the head office in terms of these articles and media reports that people don't like this, and you're probably going to have much more animosity than you are to gain in savings if you go ahead with it. So I guess we should all be aware that this might be happening and let our local store or the head office know that this is not something that we relish and we don't like being treated like criminals.
But what about, I mean, I would say, okay, maybe, but why would they have installed those gates at groceries that don't have this receipt scanning thing yet? Not because they're not going to do it.
Yeah, I guess they're just trying different ways. You know, every store is configured differently, so some of them might not have the room to set up a gate. So they're just trying different things.
Okay, I'm going to take a call from Barry in North York. Hi, Barry.
Good afternoon. Another reason why I switched from that store to Walmart, it's cheaper, $6.95 for delivery, and also Eat Impact. So now I don't have to put any more money into Galen Weston's pocket, and that makes me so happy.
Okay, Barry, thank you for that. Ellen, anything else you want to say about this? How long do their pilot projects usually last?
Well, they have stores across Canada, and probably it would take a few months, maybe 3 months or so, to do a decent kind of test. But still, there's a lot of mystery about what goes on. I was in Shoppers Drug Mart the other day, and they said I would get either 20 or 30,000 free points if I spent $60 plus.
Yes, I was there, and I did that too, yes.
Okay, but it turned out that we had $62, and that included the sales tax. So they said, that's not enough. You have to take out the sales tax, go buy some more things. So we bought some more things, and we got up to $72. And then I got my bill, and it says, you will find out what the points are when you get your receipt. And on my receipt, it said I had got 300 points. And it wasn't clear. And then I started reading the fine print, and it said something about how the items that were on sale, which most of mine were, didn't count.
Really?
So, oh, yeah, okay, because I did that. Really clear. If you bought something, you got the points. But now they're making it much harder with a lot of conditions.
Yeah. And if something is like, I did that too, one of the items I bought is actually quite faulty. But if I return it, they'll take away all the points.
Oh, boy.
But yeah. I don't know about that, because I think that some of the things I bought were on sale too, and I got the 20,000. The last time I did that, I got 30,000, but lightning doesn't strike twice.
Right. And I had a friend who wrote a Facebook post because she was buying something that was she thought was organized for skincare, because this bonus applied to skincare. But she bought Nivea night cream, and she said she was told this didn't count. Why? Because in that store, they had aisles 1, 2, and 3 that were devoted to skincare, but Nivea was in aisle 5. So that meant that it didn't qualify as skincare. So it was really annoying, and she couldn't get anywhere with her argument.
Okay, well, it, you know what? It's not worth arguing, because it's all computerized from Galen Weston's head office and the people who are actually working there. Unless it may be the owner of the franchise, they can't do anything about it.
Right. In fact, when we were in Shoppers, we were working with a youngish fellow who was helping us out. And then a couple of times he was looking at the self-service checkout and trying to manipulate it. And he'd say, if I were able to talk to Galen Weston, I would tell him this. So they're getting frustrated, too.
Okay. All righty. Let's wrap things up. I'm sure there will be more on this. And at some point, I definitely want to talk about big price increases in food that find their way back to the grocery stores who are blaming suppliers. Ellen Roseman, thanks so much.
Thanks, Libby. Bye.
All right. We are taking another break. And when we come back, wow, an AI companion for people with dementia. We'll talk about that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. We've talked a lot about the shortage of personal support workers who can provide companionship as well as physical help for people with dementia and other issues. Well, that's why researchers in Australia have developed an artificial intelligence companion named Viv, who offers conversation and compassion at a seniors facility in Sydney.
Sometimes it's nice to be alone, but it's lovely to be in company of other people and share memories from time to time. Different people, different countries.
You're absolutely right, my dear. It's so important to have moments where we can appreciate the diverse and vibrant nature of the world around us.
Well, is this the future? Of course, Viv is the one with the English accent. And the numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Dr. Adriana Schnall, Program Director, Kaczynski Center for Innovations in Caregiving, and Technology Analyst and Journalist, Carmi Levy. Hi, both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Thanks so much for having us.
Dr. Schnall, what do you make of this? I know we've seen sort of caregiving robots in Japan.
Listen, we don't even have to go that far. We have them in Canada as well, and BACRES is studying and then supporting some of them. I think this is the way of not just the future, but the present. I don't think it's instead of, but it's in addition to what we currently have. And human contact is really crucial, but there's ways that we can improve care. And these are some solutions that can help us with that.
I have to say that as exciting as this looks, I frankly find it a little bit creepy, Carmi.
It certainly sounds a little bit creepy at first, but I think that's largely because so much of the narrative around artificial intelligence has been largely negative, dystopian, sort of evoking Hollywood movie-like tropes to kind of stoke fear. And that's ultimately what gets the headlines. But in the shadows of that, we've seen some very effective point applications of artificial intelligence that do hold incredible promise in the healthcare space. And I would say that companion bots, care bots like this one, like the one that Dr. Schnell describes being used at Baycrest, they aren't just the future. She's absolutely right. They are the present. And I think we owe it to ourselves to dispel the negative notions that we've heard about AI and ask ourselves, where can it be applied with those blinkers on, with that tight focus in areas where healthcare currently struggles? And how can it complement many of the resources that we have? How can it extend our capabilities, not replace humans, as Dr. Schnell said, but certainly extend what we're able to do with the resources that we've got and fill in a lot of the gaps that we're currently struggling with? I think it makes a lot of sense. And even though we certainly need better protections in place, and we can certainly work those out as we go along, I don't think it's impossible. And I think that the upside here is significantly greater than the downside.
One of the things I wonder about, Dr. Schnell, if this becomes widespread, will this change the nature of normal human interaction? I mean, Viv apparently is like always sympathetic, always listening, in a certain way. I mean, will it change expectations of what actual humans behave like?
Well, that is a big question, because it's going to make us all look really bad. We humans have emotions which get in the way of interactions in all of our relationships. And, when we're angry, it's very hard to mask that. Whereas these robots don't have the interference of their feelings about the person they're speaking to or supporting, which in many ways is a plus. Just think of a daughter, if the father has, or a partner of somebody with a dementia, where you're being asked the same question over and over and over. No matter how loving and patient you are, people lose it after a while. And these robots won't lose it. And how great is that for the person with dementia, right? So it's not either or. They won't make us look bad. Is that they're different, right? It's because they're not relationships in the same way as we think of relationships with humans, amongst humans.
Right. Okay. But the person on the other end of this wouldn't be aware of that, Carmi.
Yeah, we always, we caution when consuming artificial intelligence related products that knowledge that it is AI is crucial. Look no further than the controversy over Princess Catherine's doctored photo using AI tools. We didn't know that.
Wait a minute. AI tools? I thought it was just Photoshop.
Photoshop increasingly uses artificial intelligence to raise the fidelity. And so
Bad job, AI.
That's right. But we are entering a world of synthetic content. And this is another example of that. And so part of legislation like the European Union's AI Act is transparency in labeling content, so that we know that it's AI when we are consuming it, so we can make that call. No, this is not a human, it's a technology. Obviously, those lines become somewhat blurred when you're applying this technology in Alzheimer's care, because how do we know full well that the patient is conscious and aware of the fact that this is, in fact, technology, not human? So, we have to come up with better ways of maintaining AI-related visibility for all stakeholders, including the patient as well as caregivers. But again, that's not an impossible obstacle to overcome. And I think as long as we all go into it with our eyes open, with the best of intentions, and I certainly think that's the case here, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It's not like anyone is trying to fool anyone. We're not trying to throw an election or sell people something they don't deserve or defraud them. This really is about raising standards of care. And I think the guardrails that we need to put in place to ensure that we're aware of the limits of humanity and technology should be pretty easy to do.
Dr. Chennault, I don't think there's any way to see that patients with dementia are going to be aware of this, is there?
No. I mean, we don't know. But I beg, you know, the question then becomes, do people with dementia need to know that it's AI if it's comforting to them? Right? So at some point, a way that we work with people living with dementia is always to try to make them comfortable. So we don't argue with them. If they say, oh, please call my mom, she's waiting for me, and we know that the person's mother's been long dead, we don't necessarily challenge those thoughts and say, well, you know your mother's dead. Why are you asking me to call your mother? We go along with it because the most important thing is for them to have comfort and feel safe and secure. In a world where you don't remember anything, safety and security matter. So this is a whole other conversation. But at the end of the day, does it really matter to the person of dementia if they're feeling comforted, if their feelings of safety are being managed this way better? And again, it's another ethical discussion. But our priority is to make people living with dementia feel safe, secure, cared for.
Carmi, what kind of technology is needed for this?
Well, I mean, it can take many forms. You know, in the Japanese experience, it's been based on a kind of a humanoid-like robot. It could be a computer that you talk to. It could be an avatar on a tablet that is in a hardened case that can kind of survive the environment in a long-term care facility, for example. So it can take on many forms. The core is essentially like a souped-up version of the ChatGPT chatbot that we've all come to know and love. It's based on that technology, but it is very customized for a particular use case, in this case, in the medical space for Alzheimer's and dementia patients. So depending on the particular application, it might look different, but on the underlying technology is very similar to a lot of the AI tools that we've been using and experimenting with over the last year and a half and since ChatGPT first became a thing. And we're starting to become sort of more familiar with what those form factors look like, what works best, what doesn't. And a lot of the pilot programs that we're seeing in care situations are going to help sort of flesh that out, refine what things look and work like.
Dr. Chennault, final question. Is that coming soon to a care facility near us?
It's not just coming soon. It's here already. And those that think that it's not here are mistaken. We need to, I mean, innovation is an important part of the healthcare culture of our society. And as long as we're using it in ways to support those living with dementia, older adults, and anybody that actually benefits from these technologies, why not? We would be fools not to. And so it's here. As Carmi said, the task, our next task, is to make sure that it's used safely, that we have parameters and guidelines and legislation that supports it.
Okay, very interesting. On that note, we wrap things up. Thank you so much, Carmi Levy and Dr. Adriana Chennault. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
And that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.